The notion that governments and businesses could rely on computers to make critical decisions rather than depend on bankers, lawyers, doctors, and other experts was once only the stuff of science fiction. But as Ian Ayres explains in his latest book, Super Crunchers, computers that crunch huge amounts of randomized data are used routinely now to make financial policy and medical decisions. And that's because those statistics-based decisions have been shown in study after study to be better than those of most experienced experts. Mr. Ayres is a lawyer and econometrician and a professor in Yale School of Management. His book is published by Bantam, and I'm very pleased it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
You've written that you use super crunching yourself to help you choose the title for your book. How did that process work?
Well, it's really anybody can do it. Google AdWords has a wonderful feature where you can put up multiple ads and they'll show them to people at random. People who search for beer, half the time they could see tastes great and half the time they could see less filling. And you can just watch and see which produces a greater click-through rate. And I did that with a couple different titles, and Super Crunchers came out on top.
Really? Well, in the past, I think either the author or the editor came up with the title. And War and Peace was pretty good. I don't know whether Tolstoy needed any computer to help him with that.
Well, you know, intuition and expertise still has its role, but the new trend is you have to be willing to put your hunches to the test.
So when Super Crunchers came up, you said, well, my intuition tells me this is a catchy title. I'll use it.
Well, or, you know, I actually started off liking the title The End of Intuition, but and my editor had the idea of Super Crunchers, and we were discussing it in a serious manner, and I liked the idea that the numbers decided the dispute.
How large are the typical data sets used for Super Crunch?
Monstrously large, in a literal sense. The Greek prefix tera comes from the term monster, and it's terabytes or 1,000 gigabytes, and they're now terabytes of data, petabytes, which is 1,000 terabytes. These are things that are multiples of the Library of Congress that are now being crunched.
When did analyzing that much data become even possible?
Well, it's all within the last decade. We tend to think that CPUs, the processing capacity of computers, was important. But for super crunching, it's really the ability to capture digital information and store it cheaply that's been the real turnaround.
Do the data sets need to be really large in order to produce a useful result?
No. Often small data sets can also beat out human predictors. But increasingly, you can get large data sets, and so why not use it?
And the sets are always described as randomized. Can you explain how data is randomized?
Well, they're not always randomized. And actually, I'd say these are two complementary approaches. One is to take non-random historical data and to data mine it and to find hidden factors that cause things. The other approach is to run randomized tests to create your own data using a randomized trial that the same methodology that's been used in medicine for decades is now being used on the internet and out in the real world.
And for these, they use mathematical algorithms?
They do, but I mean, the randomized studies are quite simple. Just like the Google AdWords experiments, you at random show some people one thing and something half the time another. You can randomize over what the impact is of a different hiring standard. What if we at random took some of the people that we're rejecting? Are they going to end up doing just as well? And you can, or if we started giving to insurance at random to some of our rejects, you can go in and find out maybe that your standards need to be revised.
So that is interesting, because I am sure that in any number of instances, the wrong person was chosen for a job when I applied, that I should have gotten that job. And there have been instances where I've seen people hired by my company knowing that there have been many applicants, that any number of them had to have been better than the one that was finally chosen. But how do computers go back and say, you know, John Jones, who you eliminated, would have really been the best person?
Well, one of the beautiful thing about computers and statistics is that they'll not only make a prediction, I mean, and sometimes if it's, but they will simultaneously tell you the precision of the prediction, so that if you have a small randomized test, the prediction won't be as accurate. And this is a huge difference between humans and computers, because we're not only biased in making predictions, but humans are damnably overconfident. And they either won't tell you their degree of precision, or they'll be overconfident. And the computer will spit out simultaneously an estimate of whether it had good data or not.
And the computer isn't bowled over by good looks or nice clothing.
Exactly right. And
you've said data mining can let business emulate a kind of aggregate omniscience. Does Netflix use data mining to figure out which rental movies to recommend?
Yes, and it's very effective. The recommendation system lets them make recommendations for that people like you tend to like these movies, and the recommended movies come back, and after the fact they're rated about a star higher than the unrecommended movies, the ones that people choose on their own.
So they're looking at my rental history to determine that, or at least the movies I've inquired about.
Well, the ones,
and I would assume that Amazon does pretty much the same thing when they tell me other books you might like.
Exactly right. And I'm generally a fan. When super crunching is done on quality, it tends to help consumers, helps you find the products, the services that you want. It becomes more problematic when it's super crunching is done on price. Hold on to your wallet.
My guest is Ian Ayres, A-Y-R-E-S. His book, Super Crunchers, is published by Bantam. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Didn't you learn that Visa credit cards now can predict which couples are likely to divorce by examining their credit card purchases?
They can, and it's there's a limit to the degree of accuracy, but certain charge patterns are more associated with divorce. Firms like Axiom divide people into 70 different lifestyle groups, and this includes, again, predictions about whether your marriage is likely to last. Listeners can even go, I've created a way that you yourself can predict the likelihood that your marriage will last. If you go to supercrunchers.com, there are 30 or so prediction tools that will help you predict your child's height or how long your marriage will last. You put in 5 or 6 variables, and it'll come up with an estimate.
Well, I assume that bills from a couples counselor might actually have an effect on that number crunching. Didn't Walmart use data mining to learn that it should rush strawberry Pop-Tarts to the Florida stores in the path of Hurricane Ivan in 2004? This gets kind of complicated.
It is, and it's a great example, because there are sometimes patterns that casual observers wouldn't have realized, but it turns out that right after a hurricane, people like the gooey warmth of a Pop-Tart, and they tend to buy it after a hurricane. And so Walmart's recognize that from past hurricanes, and they start shipping it before the hurricanes hit.
I guess I'm going to have to wait until a hurricane hits before I buy a Pop-Tart. You've described how economists use a tool called regression to analyze data and make predictions about the future. Can you explain what a regression analysis is?
Yes. It's really an equation that simply allows for there to be multiple factors of influence. And one of the first regressions I talk about in the book is a regression, an equation that tries to predict the quality of Bordeaux wine on the basis of what the temperature was and what the rainfall was at various times in the year.
Well, the French will say you have to know about the terroir as well. they put that in too?
Well, they put in various controls for the location of the Bordeaux, but this is a fairly crude regression. And one of the big lessons of these simple equations is just a few variables can do a great job of beating the experts. We tend to think that when it's really complicated, that's when you need a human expert to make the prediction. But the more factors, that's actually when humans start doing the worst. And to have a regression with five or six predictors time and time again comes up with better predictions.
Is Robert Parker aware of these computer programs?
He is, and he is incredibly dismissive. He said, who would want to have dinner with these statisticians? It's a sham. Time and time again, these have made very accurate predictions. Even before the wine can be tasted, you can start making accurate predictions about what the ultimate quality will be.
Why is it called a regression analysis?
Well, because the first regressions were done by a cousin of Darwin, a guy named Galton, who started doing regressions on to predict child height based on the parents' height, and it was a regression toward the mean. And that's just because that first process exhibited a regression toward the mean, we've gotten the name for all processes.
So we've been doing this for a long time before there were computers, except that computers allow us to do all sorts of things that that in the past a contemporary of Darwin could not have imagined.
Exactly right, and at nanoseconds of speed.
You pointed out, in other words, you're not saying times three, carry over the two. You've pointed out that much has been written in books like Freakonomics by Stephen D. Levitt and Stephen J. Dubner about how widespread the use of statistics has become. But hasn't far less attention been paid to how widely these statistics are being used to drive decision making?
That's a main theme of the book. These are impacting our lives as employees, as consumers, all over the place in field after field. It's starting to impact how decisions are made.
And you're saying that not just with Bordeaux wine, but decisions made through statistical analysis have been more accurate than decisions made by experts in most or in all cases?
It's not all cases. There are some cases where experts do just as well. There are few cases where experts do better.
And I feel a little relief there.
But, you'd be scared at how often, 30-40% of the time, it's decisively that the computers do better. One test you won't believe had to do with Supreme Court votes. Some researchers assembled 83 legal experts over half of them had clerked on the Supreme Court. These are luminaries of the legal field, and they asked them to predict all the justices' votes for the 2002 term, and a statistical program that just controlled for six variables did better at predicting the votes. You'd think that it would have none of the legal issues were concluded in the statistical package. Just crude things like, was the government a participant? Was the lower court opinion liberal or conservative? You could do a much better job of predicting Justice Kennedy and Justice O'Connor's votes.
And the soft sciences are taking advantage of super crunching as well. The online dating services like eHarmony, aren't they using super crunching to match clients?
Yep, and it's a new kind of a wisdom of crowds. In the old days, a dating service would ask you who you think you'd like to go out with, and they would take your preferences primarily. That would drive their decisions. Now, eHarmony doesn't care so much who you think you want to go out with. They code what kind of personality you have, and then they crunch data what types of personality make happy marriages, and they will match you with people that you might not have thought you'd like.
Well, the old computer dating systems might ask you, do you like art? And you'd say yes, and so would somebody else say yes, but your idea of what art is and what the other person's idea of art was were two very different things. But if you know personalities, then they're probably going to have similar attitudes toward art.
Or indeed, it all becomes an empirical question. Is art really being compatible on art? Is that even important to whether you'll argue about the checkbook or not? Maybe it's instead has to do more with how you line up on the Briggs-Meyer personality scale of being introverted or extroverted or how you feel about family. They try to crunch the numbers and get down to the basics of what will work.
My guest is Ian Ayres, who is a professor at Yale School of Management and the author of Super Crunchers, It is published by Bantam Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us.
WNYC support comes from the law firm of Cowan, Leibowitz & Latman. Known for trademark, copyright, and patent law, Cowan has also given general corporate and personal legal advice to businesses and executives for over 50 years. More at CLL.com.
The Cooper Union, presenting a free lecture by Douglas Brinkley commemorating the 50th anniversary of the publication of Jack Kerouac's On the Road, Thursday at 6:30, 51 Astor Place between 3rd and 4th Avenues. The River to River Festival and American Express, free music, art, and dance downtown. This week, a discussion with playwright Edward Albee, followed by a screening of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? Details, rivertoriverNYC.com.
The documentary Bling, a Planet Rock, follows three rappers on a journey to Sierra Leone. Today on Soundcheck, the filmmaker talks about the link between blood diamonds and hip-hop culture. That's coming up at 2 on 93.9 FM, WNYC. My guest is Ian Ayres, who is an econometrician and a lawyer. He's the William K. Townsend Professor at Yale Law School and a professor at Yale School of Management. He's also, I'm sure some of you recognize, a regular contributor to Marketplace, which is heard every day on this station. And he's written a book called Super Crunchers. It is published by Bantam Books. Hasn't super crunching even begun to drive the financing of movies based on specific characteristics of their scripts? Is this a reason why movies have become so formulaic?
Well, possibly. A firm called Epagogics is crunching numbers to predict how many tickets a movie will sell. And and this is really controversial. They'll even make script suggestions on how to revise the script to make it sell more. Add a buddy character, change the venue. Location apparently matters a lot in their predictions. And they'll say and if you do these two things, you'll make an extra $7 million of tickets.
And has that panned out?
Yes, but not perfectly. So a major studio ran a test of 9 movies, and Epagogics was able to predict 6 of the 9. Now, that doesn't sound like perfect, but traditionally studios can only predict about one-third instead of two-thirds of the movies.
Well, I'm not sure I want a studio to tell me to move the setting from New York to Chicago.
Yeah, I'm actually come out on both sides of this. I'm troubled, and I'm partly revolted by it. Maybe it's the death of art, but you know, the Epagogics did not begin the idea of producers messing with scripts. And at least if you're going to mess with a script, you should do it on basis of good information instead of bad information. And it might even be we've had formulaic genre movies long before Epagogics. It could actually be that the regressions lead to more diversity than less.
But can we say that this trend doesn't bode well for the people who are considered experts in their fields?
They are definitely gored by this. In field after field, traditional experts, especially line employees, are losing discretion. It used to be that a bank officer had discretion on who got a loan, and now bank officers are glorified secretaries who just enter data and the computer prints out it. At radio stations, it used to be that the local program director got to decide. Now Clear Channel makes a centralized decision based on numbers.
On what records will be played when and what shows will be broadcast at what hours.
But this same process, it's starting to limit grade school teachers' discretion. And this is really troubling, but the best evidence right now is that a completely scripted reading program called Direct Instruction does a lot better job than discretionary programs. That we're not going to make a movie about about a teacher that is following a script, but these incredibly scripted teaching programs that even tell the teacher how they have to respond when a student gets it right or wrong, that they do a lot better in teaching kids how to read.
I'm not sure I want to be that teacher. But the teacher in Florida whose class President Bush was visiting on the at the time when the planes hit the World Trade Center on September 11th was using DI. This is something that actually goes back to the 60s. Why has it become popular recently? Because of the super crunchers?
Well, it's in part because No Child Left Behind has mandated that educational programs be empirically supported. And so there's a great effort to try to look out and find styles of teaching that actually have some empirical support behind them. And DI is still one of the most controversial. Most teachers initially hate it because it takes away all the discretion. It is interesting. I have found some that love one aspect of it, that it's zero preparation. You just walk in,
No plans.
Exactly.
No class plans. But you've included a sample of it in your book, and it sounds pretty tedious.
It does, except there's one aspect of it that I've actually started using with my kids, and that when you ask a question, you pause, and the whole class simultaneously responds. And so from the student's perspective, they're on call to answer 8 questions a minute, and that's a little bit more engaged than traditional education.
Well, does DI, or I call it DI, yeah, work for all types of teaching, or is it best for working with young children who are learning the basics?
Well, it's...
organic chemistry using DI? I'm not sure that would
work. It's kind of interesting that it's that the scripted instruction does the best at the lowest levels and actually then back at the highest levels. So actually for AP, it comes back to being a scripted thing, does better. But primarily, this is a system that works for kids that are reading below grade. It works great for economically challenged kids. And this is an unpleasant truth, but if you have a school system which doesn't have a super teachers, this is it's easier to get people to follow a script. And it's not, they've found this out in sales too. If you have any mass organization, sure, there could be some great salespeople, there could be some great loan officers, there can be some great teachers, but if you're trying to figure out the best way to get 1,000 people to do something, to have a centralized script that has been tested is probably the best way of getting results.
Medicine is another field in which the use of super crunching has had an impact, isn't it?
A tremendous impact, and physicians are starting to lose discretion too. Some report that they feel like they're just an alternative to WebMD portal, that people, instead of bowing down to their expertise, they want to say, show me the study. They want to reach past the physician and find out what the super cruncher said was the best diagnosis. And one of the great positive changes that I think people haven't emphasized enough, back in the 60s and 70s, physicians rarely did patient-specific research. If you think back to the 60s, your doctor's office didn't have a library, and so there's just no way they could do it. Now, every physician has the internet and an ability to do patient-specific research, and you don't need to do it for the common cold, but about a third of the time, it's useful to hop on and find out what the library says.
Well, it can work the other way too. In some cases, super crunching seems to have resulted in the first hard evidence that's ever been available to support the use of some existing medical practices. So doctors who have worked on anecdotal evidence can now say, you see, I was right all along.
Exactly. And so there's this wonderful chicken and egg problem that's been somehow solved, because back in the old days, doctors weren't looking, but there wasn't anything to look for. Now we have the internet. We have tons of studies that are out here. And indeed, every treatment now has a level of evidence grade associated with it. And some are based just on experience and intuition. Some are based on regressions. The highest are based on multiple randomized studies. And you have a sense not only what the state-of-the-art treatment is, but what the quality of evidence behind it is.
Has super crunching been applied to debunk some of the persistent medical myths?
Yes, echinacea is one that they've had a meta study that's come out that's now pushed against it. One of the beautiful things.
What happened? Echinacea turns out not to help forestall a cold?
Yeah, that's right. I think that's where the bulk is. But an interesting thing that's happened, another set of researchers have reanalyzed the data, and there's a bit of a fight. Some people are trying to hold on. And a point here is that super crunching is not without flaws, and that you don't want to rely on any single super crunchers. I like the contestability, and hopefully we'll start to develop a consensus among the statistically literate about which way, whether it works or not.
Well, statistics have a reputation for being worse than lies or damn lies, as somebody once said. So, because you can use statistics any way you want. Super crunching is an attempt to take the bias out of the use of statistics?
That's right. And it's not going to be perfect. The regressions particularly, you're going to want to have multiple people take a look at it. But I'm actually one of the great values of randomized studies is that they're so transparent. You give this drug to half the people by chance, and you don't give it to the other, and you just actually compare the averages. There's not too much to trust me statistics involved. And so randomized experiments that are happening, by the way, with regard to all kinds of governmental policies, provide very powerful, clear data about what works and what doesn't.
Including, for example, that vitamin B12 deficiencies can be treated with vitamin pills as well as with shots. In the past, people said the shots were more effective. And patching the eye to provide comfort and healing in patients turns out to be unnecessary as well.
Exactly right. But what we've learned that some things do work, that taping, something as simple as taping knees actually in a randomized study seems to alleviate knee soreness of a certain type. And
You mean just putting an athletic tape?
Around the bottom of the knee. And so you can come in. This is not, by the way, hostile to alternative medicine. It just means that you have to be willing to put the alternative medicines to the test. And
on the other hand, estrogen therapy, the results seem to be quite controversial.
That's right. And we've gone through the Women's Health Initiative has done massive randomized testing on low-fat diets, on a variety of things. And to say that we pull out initial results, it doesn't always end the conversation, but it certainly deserves a place at the table.
My guest is Ian Ayres. His book, Super Crunchers, is published by Bantam. Well, even in the face of new evidence, isn't it difficult for many people to change their long-held beliefs?
Yes, especially when their jobs depend on it. It's not just narrow self-interest. There's an iron law that it's hardest to see how super crunching could impact your own decisions. It's easy for people to say, oh, I can see how it can help the other guy. But even for myself to try to think, where could I start using some testing in as a professor or as an author? It's often a struggle. I can see, starting with epagogics, I can see, well, if you can predict movie sales, maybe you could predict novels, but it's harder for me to think about coding up nonfiction books, which is more the game that I play. I'll say my son and I recently have been coding up interviews from the Colbert Report, and we've been trying to see if we can actually predict what kind of questions will be asked, in at least on certain by certain interviewers. And so you might, but it's the hardest thing to do is to apply it to yourself.
Well, in the case of Colbert, the predictable is the unpredictable, isn't it?
Well,
someone like me, the predictable is the predictable.
I see, that's what you'd think, but Colbert might not be able to see race, but he certainly sees sex. He doesn't ask as hostile questions his female guests, and we've coded for two or three other attributes, whether the guest is famous or whether the guest is identifiably liberal or not. And there are three or four results that come out that are kind of interesting.
We are about to get reports on what's happening in Iraq. Could you supercrunch the possibility of success or failure there, or do we have to rely on politicians and military people to tell us? They're the old experts, aren't they?
Yeah, supercrunching can't predict everything. It's going to be best when there are repeated things that have happened in the past that are comparable, and I doubt this. But on the micro, you still might be able to productively even do some randomized experiments in Iraq. You have a bunch of different villages, and to try, should we do X or Y? And to do some, and if you're not sure, then you might try some randomization and see which has the best micro effect.
Although most computer analysis is focused on treatment decisions for doctors, you've described some new medical software called Isabel that instead focuses on diagnostic decisions. What inspired the development of Isabel software?
Well, Isabel was a young girl that went to an emergency room in London and almost died, and her because she was misdiagnosed. And her father, who at the time was an investment banker, changed paths and decided to start a company to improve diagnosis. And he started to create a data set linking symptoms and test results to diagnosis. And he's created a software that's very effective. It gives you a physician's a list of the top 10 or 12 diagnoses that are consistent. And at least it gives them a universe of 12 things that they should think about.
Because sometimes things are slightly asymptomatic and they might miss something, but this might give it to them. Are they receptive to this software in general?
Some are. It's still...
Because we're seeing more and more laptops and desktops in doctors' offices.
But there's some that are open to it. But, you know, diagnosis is the last bastion of physician discretion. They've lost the discretion on treatment decisions once the diagnosis is in. And a lot of them say, well, this is what is the art of diagnosis. And we're going to very quickly come to the point where we have much, much better and bigger data on the experiences of all admitted patients, we can start taking advantage of that to make sure that people get the right kind of treatments.
One of the most fascinating people you've written about in your book is a doctor named Don Berwick, who's a pediatrician and president of the Institute for Healthcare Improvement. Hasn't he been able to use supercrunching to suggest simple changes in hospital procedures?
Yes. He launched the 100,000 Lives campaign just a few years ago, and he got 2/3 of the hospital beds signed up to participate in this campaign, where the participating hospitals agreed to just do 5 very routinized procedures to try to reduce hospital deaths. And he used supercrunching first to identify where people actually dying in hospitals. A lot of people die when they have centerline infections from centerline catheters inserted into them. And so he developed a set of procedures to stop the infections, to wash your hands and to scrub down the place where the catheter is inserted. And he used supercrunching to justify the procedures and then used supercrunching to determine whether or not there really was a reduction in mortality. And he made his $100,000 lives promise actually in less than 2 years.
He may make a lot of money because he's been propose for a Nobel Prize for medicine, and they get big bucks. My great hope is that this will eliminate a lot of, I hate to say this because I'm sure there are people out there working as consultants, but whenever we hear in the radio business, we're bringing in a consultant, we know that that means that we're going to hear something stupid. Forgive me for saying that. Maybe we can super crunch the future of this business. Super Crunches is Ian Ayres' book. It is published by Bantam. Mr. Ayres is a professor at Yale Law School and a professor at Yale School for Management. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, John Turturro talks about his latest film, a romantic musical comedy. Then short story writer George Saunders on his first collection of nonfiction, plus Edward P. Jones and two young writers talk about new fiction that's coming from the South. And the guest on our latest Underreported is recently released Ethiopian political prisoner Dr. Berhanu Nega. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs on WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English and Blakeney Schick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Rory Bernstein, Stephen Valentino, and Scott Goldberg. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. And we'll see you tomorrow.